We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovic. Joining me today is Bob Coleman from Idaho Armored Vaults. We're doing a bit of a special kind of update on the silver market. There was some recent information brought to light by Bob on Twitter, and some of you asked to have it covered. So here we are. Bob, thanks for joining me this evening.
Sure, my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
So I think where we should start is, you and I have discussed premiums in the past, and we've seen premiums jump up a lot on, let's say, physical metal over the last year. So why don't you start by explaining to us how you look at premiums, where they start from that process of up the line, where you guys end up as, let's say, as bullion retailers, why those premiums start rising, and kind of get into the whole picture of where these premiums go.
Yeah, that's a good question, because really the premium started to jump back in 2020 when COVID broke out, and you had the precious metal prices tank in March of 2020. That spurred on a lot of buying, and then all of a sudden that buying coincided with logistics and production issues because of shutdowns and reductions of staff and that type of thing. So then you had diminished supply out there, and then that added to even more tightness. And so the retail dealers started the process of jumping premiums ahead of the wholesalers back then. They went pretty fast and furious to the upside. And the average premiums, the spreads between wholesale rates and retail rates were fairly large. And then they leveled off as you got closer to the end of the year because demand started to slow down, prices were pulling back, and people just didn't have the interest. Well, then you fast forward to February, and the silver spike and so forth and the push for physical metal. There you had an interesting development because, well, the retail dealers again jumped out in front by jamming premiums much higher than the wholesalers. But the wholesalers at this point started to realize, well, wait a second, because if we run into production issues and delays and so forth, we need to start accounting for higher premiums just because we don't know where the price or the premium may be when we go to place orders with a mint or refiner, you know, 2 weeks from now when we sell out our inventory today. So they started to increase premiums on their front, which then the retailers sort of, because they were already high to begin with, their profit margins may have been compacted a little bit because when they were going back out into the market and replenishing their inventory, they were actually having to pay more premium to the wholesaler. But the jump in premium, certain products really took off, like Silver Eagles, they're very expensive. And Gold Eagles, they're expensive too, no question about it. But the other products hadn't jumped as much. So one of the things that I've been on Twitter trying to educate on is how much people should be paying over spot for physical metal. And one of the examples I constantly go to is silver 100-ounce bars. I've been consistently selling silver 100-ounce bars at $3.30 over spot since early February. Never really raised, I'm dependent on whatever the wholesalers charge for those bars. But my goal is to get clients involved in the metals and participate in the metals and not dissuade them from high premiums. And so we have a very low markup on product, and it's really the loyalty that I have to the client base that of why I do that. I want to see people get into this asset class because it does have a lot of advantages to it that other asset classes can't provide. And so what started happening is people started calling me from around the country and even outside the country and saying, listen, this is what I paid for my metal. How much are you selling the same product for? And they started to realize that some of these retail dealers were really marking up product very excessively. And that started putting a bad taste in people's mouths. And so I wanted to kind of create a little bit of a campaign on Twitter is at least educate yourself. Try to call around or ask questions of as many dealers possible so you can kind of understand the market a lot better and you're not just taking a retail dealer's word for it. Because it's in this day and age, a lot of people tend to listen to, to podcasts or interviews or YouTube, that type of thing, and they tend to get some type of relationship or some type of trust going with that interviewer or interviewee, and then they call them up and ask them to, you know, how much to buy metal from, and they end up buying from that person. But they just don't really shop around and understand that, you know, that might be, you know, an excessive price. And I mean, as prices go up, people don't really care as much. But if prices get into a trading range and then they realize that they could have saved $2 an ounce on silver, that's a lot of money. Especially if you're talking 5,000 ounces, that's $10,000 extra that you could have saved and just, you know, put in your pocket or bought more silver with.
Absolutely. And like you say, I mean, obviously you're going to get accused of talking your book here, but you and I have spoken about this before, and it seems that, you know, when people end up with a, let's say, being left with a bad taste in their mouth, this is damaging for the industry as a whole, right?
Correct. Yeah. And I'm not here to say, hey, listen, you know, buy from me. I mean, if you have a great relationship with your dealer, by far, but, you know, by all means, stay with your dealer. I'm not saying just completely jump ship, but the dealer should have a responsibility to the client to offer something that's in the client's interest as well. So, you know, obviously everyone wants to be competitive, and I understand every dealer needs to make money. That's not the question at all. It's a matter of how much money is enough and allowing the client the ability to try to make money in this business. I mean, because at the end of the day, buying metal is like an investment. I mean, you want to have the ability to walk away if prices go up and you want to get out of the product, you know, that there's a chance to make money on it. I mean, if you have to make a 60% move in the price of metals just to break even, is that an investment or has that become more of a lottery ticket? You know, that's where I try to always look for the best possible product, you know, the best price product and what's available. Because that's the other question customers need to ask is, what do you actually have on the shelf that you can sell or that you know will be coming in, let's say, in a week or two? Because I've seen this in the past where dealers will sell product they don't have, and then the client doesn't receive the inventory for over a month or even longer. And then you start to roll into this 28-day rule, which the CFTC basically says if you do a physical transaction paid for in cash and it's under 28 days, you're not regulated by the CFTC. But if you do a transaction where it takes over 28 days to get delivery, that throws you into a forward contract. It becomes a different world altogether. And that's one of the reasons why I got up on Twitter today, is that we're seeing production issues and issues to garner blanks and so forth to make these silver products, you know, from mints and so forth. And the delays are becoming a little bit longer now. And the wholesalers, from what I'm hearing, there may be some of them that are heavily short product, meaning they've sold product that they don't have, expecting to get it from the mint or refiner. And now the mint or refiner is saying, hey, listen, I can only provide so much each week, or maybe 2 weeks from now, or maybe 3 weeks from now, but don't ask me for any more. And then all of a sudden, you start to run into this risk that a dealer may not be able to provide a delivery of that actual product within a specific stated period of time.
And is this part of what you were saying in that tweet, that this creates a regulatory and counterparty risk?
Yeah, because at some point, as a customer starts to make waves and says, listen, I paid for this metal, I'm demanding it, and you have to provide it to me. Otherwise, I'm going to go ahead and cancel the trade, or I want my money back. Or worse, the dealer then has to go out into the market and buy the product, whatever is available at whatever the prevailing premiums are. They may end up taking a loss on that transaction just to fulfill delivery of that product. That's why this becomes not necessarily a spot price issue. It becomes a premium risk issue, because the wholesaler or retail dealer has no control over the premium. That's a market function that's purely a supply and demand issue. And at any point, just like with lumber prices today, I mean, if you go to build a house, you're going to pay a lot more for that 4x8 sheet of plywood. You don't have a choice in the matter. You're either going to pay up for it or you don't get it. Well, the same thing happens in the silver market. You know, a wholesaler has sold too much metal. They can't actually source it. And now their risk of violating this 28-day rule, you know, they have repercussions from the CFTC. So they could be squeezed on both sides of the transaction.
So my whole goal doing these podcasts is to help educate people, to show people both sides of the coin, to facilitate a discussion to really bring things to light. So we've had John Adams on a couple times now, and I'm sure you're well aware, and our listeners are well aware of his crusade to really inform people to convert, let's say, their unallocated or pooled accounts into allocated storage. So why don't we talk a little bit about some of these programs and the risks that you also see with unallocated or pooled accounts?
Sure. Yeah, the unallocated accounts basically are balance sheet or inventory financing programs for the most part. You are giving a firm your money and they are using that for financing inventory or production of material. That's basically the underlying notion for a lot of these programs. Where the problem lies is where people start to demand the product, or worse, they just want their money back. And in this type of environment, it may not be as big of an issue if you just want your money back, because the prices have been going up and there's been a lot of activity and a lot of mints and refiners are probably making a lot of money. But in a downtime, if you wanted your money and inventory is not moving and they're just sitting on the stuff and cash flow is poor, then you have more of a cash concern. But the other side of the equation, if you want your metal and their production is so hectic that they're using this material and they have to constantly resource the material to replace it with, that's where you start to get into these tightness issues where they may not have the metal available or they just have a delivery for delay. And a lot of customers or investors in this industry, sometimes they equate delay for basically they don't have it. And you jump to conclusions very quickly. It's just the nature of the beast of the physical metals market, because we all buy precious metals, you know, partly because we don't trust, you know, counterparties. We want to have something that's free from someone else's promise. It's just that the way a lot of these programs are sold by sponsors or sales agents, that type of thing, is that they basically make it sound like, hey, it's a convenient program. You don't have to pay any storage fees. And if you ever want your metal, you just ask for it. And for a lot of people, they say, well, God, that sounds great. It's these types of times that start to run the risks of, hey, listen, if you want your metal, you may not be able to get it. And that's where you start to see a panic. And then you move to the pooled accounts, these pooled type accounts, very similar in structure. Again, the underlying factor is the client really has no oversight over the program. It's just an obligation from the sponsor to provide metal or to provide a settlement on a transaction. Beyond that, the terms and conditions in these contracts tend to be very broad, and they can be changed at any time. And on top of all that, you have force majeure clauses that says, listen, if we can't deliver the metal beyond, you know, something beyond our control, we can claim force majeure, and we therefore don't have to deliver it in the first place. And you're agreeing to all of this. So clients apparently may be completely unaware that they're signing away any recourse that they may have against the program, which basically means they have to sit and wait either till metal comes in and the program can provide delivery, or they just sell out their commitment to the program and just receive a cash distribution.
That was my question. In the force majeure instance, let's say, is don't they have to pay that out in like the cash value instead of delivering the physical metal?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly could be a cash settlement. Then that's something that could happen. It could just be a force majeure where it says, listen, we don't have the metal right now, but yeah, it's just a matter of time before it goes through the sourcing process of coming out of the mine, melting it down, refining it down into a finer form, and then we'll eventually have those bars for you. It just depends on the program and the strength and balance sheet of that program. So, you know, the Perth Mint obviously is a very large program. They do a lot of business versus, you know, if you have a small refiner that, you know, is not very well known, the hallmarks aren't very, they're not as in demand. They may not have the fortitude or the balance sheet to withstand a big withdrawal or a demand for metal or cash settlement. It may drain their balance sheet very quickly. Those are risks to the programs themselves. And that's, again, clients don't understand this because many don't read these agreements. And even if they read the agreement, they really don't know the intricacies and the operations of the program itself, or the refiner or the mint or the storage program. They don't know how strong they are financially. They don't know what their cash flow is like, that type of thing. These are the issues that I try to educate investors on.
Yeah, I was just thinking as you were saying that, again, this is simply to try and educate people, to bring this information to light, to really, let's say, highlight something that maybe people don't think about is this counterparty risk that is mentioned over and over, but maybe people don't necessarily think it applies in their particular program, right?
Right. And this is one of the reasons why I am so adamant about owning physical metal and holding it directly, whether it's, you know, on your person, so to speak, within arm's length, or it's at a professional depository where you hold it on a segregated basis, not allocated basis, but segregated basis. There's differences between allocated and segregated. A lot of the industry uses the term allocated very broadly as it's the safest way to store something. It's technically not. Segregated is by far the safest way to store precious metals. And that's, and again, that's educating the client. We, you know, I wrote an article over 10 years ago trying to explain the difference between allocated and segregated. It gets easily confused. I've seen storage agreements that use the word allocated and segregated in the same sentence. People have to understand that when a facility or a program, let's just say, says, hey, we store it on a allocated basis or a segregated basis, they may store it at a third-party depository for their account on a segregated basis as a general account, but the account may be set up as a master-sub relationship where, you know, client A is really the sub account of the master, which is the, say, the gold dealer, for example, and they're just leasing space from a depository. Well, the dealer can say, hey, listen, your metal is segregated, but it's technically segregated on the master side, not necessarily the client side, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Something that I've, let's say, come across and people have asked me as well, Bob, is if the government decides to, let's say, confiscate metal, in that instance, does having metal in a private depository protect it in any way, shape, or form, or is basically everybody's metal up for grabs in a situation like that?
If we went through some type of broad physical confiscation, it would be a nightmare for everybody in the country. In fact, actually, it would be more of a nightmare for contract law as well as asset protection law in general. I mean, it would show a huge weakness in whatever country is doing that. It wouldn't be just a target for gold owners. It would be a target for anybody who owns anything physically, because it's, gold is not a very heavily owned asset anymore. It's lost its appeal since even the 1980s. I mean, it just, with the advent of debt and debt securities and so forth, you have a lot more people that are in the fixed income market and the stock market than you do in metals markets. I mean, there's been a major shift over the last 50 years. And a lot of that has to do with generational and education and that type of thing and cultural values and things like that. I mean, but it doesn't mean that the asset class is any weaker or not as important. It's just right now, you know, the stock market and the bond market have been going up the last 50 years. And you know, partly because, you know, central banks' actions are, let's support asset prices at any cost. And so, you know, it's the idea that, you know, we haven't really gone through a complete washout or depression that cleanses asset prices and gets rid of all the speculation. Eventually that'll happen. But until it does, you know, a lot of attention is on paper assets or digital assets right now.
Absolutely. So, Bob, what are some other, let's say, avenues that you think people need to take a little bit more time to educate themselves on to make sure that they're understanding the risks that are associated with different programs?
Well, reading the agreements, the user agreement or the storage agreement, take the time to kind of go through that and look for red flags, look for language, you know, limits of liability or indemnification clauses or hold harmless agreements and things that provide more strength and power to the sponsor of the program than to the client. The client needs to understand that these programs, a lot of them are developed for the benefit of the sponsor, not the benefit of the client. But these agreements really provide the language and the responsibility that the sponsor has to the client. That's why, you know, throw away the marketing jargon and all the advertising. Stay with the storage agreement or the user agreement or terms and conditions, whatever you want to call it. Read those. That is actually the real responsibility of that program.
Absolutely. Do you want to give us a couple examples of, let's say, terms in some of these user agreements that you've found that really make one scratch their head and wonder if this, let's say, program has your best interest in mind?
Sure, sure. I mean, some of the more popular programs, in terms of, you know, people look at the Royal Canadian Mint, storing at the Royal Canadian Mint or a government facility, and they make it sound like that's a great place to store your metals. People have to understand government facilities, you can't sue the government if they lose your metal. There's a lot of these clauses, or a lot of the language in these agreements will have immunity clauses where you can't go after the government for them misplacing your metal. In fact, that's in Texas Depository, or run by the state of Texas, that's one of the clauses that they have in there. And just like the Royal Canadian Mint, I mean, it's a crown corporation of the Canadian government. If the Canadian government wanted to privatize the mint and take all the metal out of there, it's there for the taking. I mean, but that's a risk. It's just something people need to be aware of. And it's things like that. I mean, just try to look outside the box a little bit and ask yourself, okay, what are some of the risks out there that could hamper a program or that program could run into, and how would they deal with it, if that kind of helps you a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you give us some other examples of actual language that we should be looking out for? I know you and I, before we hit record here, we talked about a couple of these examples. So, you know, programs that put responsibility on you to understand, let's say, their proprietary technology that's involved in some of these programs, is that type of thing a red flag to you?
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about digital programs. With crypto assets in sort of hot, sort of in a fever pitch right now, and it garners a lot of attention from investors, and everyone's always looking for the next and greatest best thing and the most convenient thing and so forth. You've seen a big rise in digital programs. But the customer, what I see very regularly is in these digital programs, they promote the idea that, hey, you're just buying physical metal and you have title to the metal. And they use that type of marketing very broadly. But when you look at these agreements, it says a different thing altogether. In fact, I know we've talked about this, and I'm not a big fan of naming programs, but as an example, OneGold has a couple clauses that are concerning. That one of the clauses says exactly this: OneGold may use any funds received from you for any purpose in its sole discretion. What does that mean? I mean, does that make it sound like they can put their money toward anything? But that's a question that people need to ask themselves. I mean, it gives that program very broad latitude. And then further into the agreement, it says that you will not receive an account statement, passbook, or any other type of record evidencing your ownership of digital metal. What does that mean? I mean, I certainly, if I'm buying physical metal and I'm holding it directly, these types of clauses don't really apply to me. But it's unique in the digital side, because in the digital side, there's more moving parts. There's more, I'd say, counterparties or more...
Just maybe risks in general.
Yeah, more points of failure. There's more of everything. I look at a lot of these programs of simply trying to recreate the wheel. I mean, the easiest thing to do is just buy physical metal and put it away and hold it directly where you can reduce the counterparty risk from the equation. That's simple, but where investors are frustrated is, well, the premiums are so high, and I can't just simply buy metal because the premiums are so high. Then, of course, we talked about that earlier. And that's where a lot of these digital programs are coming up and saying, aha, we can offer a better price or a more convenient price to get into metal, and you can save a lot of money getting into it. Well, what people don't understand is they're buying into a program, and then there's multi-layer of transactions to get to the end product, which is, let's just say you only have, you know, 500 ounces of silver that you're actually going to end up taking delivery of. Well, you can't take delivery of a 1,000-ounce bar, so therefore you have to have product made, and so then you have to pay a refining cost or some sort of fee for minting that smaller product. Well, you already paid a fee just to get into the program itself. Those are the types of things that people need to be aware of when they get into these programs.
And I think something we covered with John, I believe it was last week I spoke with him, and it struck me that it seems that these programs can change the rules on you whenever it suits them. For example, I know when we covered the Perth Mint, their fabrication costs had jumped by 400% and 500% on silver and gold just to, you know, fabricate your quote unquote physical product, right? So is that another risk that is maybe hidden by the opaqueness of these contracts?
Right. I mean, one of the issues when you get into these programs, whether digital, unallocated, even allocated, is they're a closed loop system. So you don't have the benefit of being able to shop around 15 different dealers offering the same product at 15 different prices. You have to go with whatever product price that program has to offer. So take, for example, the Perth Mint, for example, and John's brought to light the worry that people have trying to get their physical metal into more of an allocated form or into more of a direct form. Well, what's to stop the program, and I'm not saying the Perth Mint does this, but what's to stop any program from starting to raise the fees for minting product just because they know that there's a demand for that product? I mean, you know, John may have the best intentions of trying to educate people, but, you know, there may be a program out there just says, hey, listen, let these people think that they can't get their metal, they'll pay up for it, and we'll make even more money. I mean, anything is possible out there. And people need to understand that when they get into these programs, they're very defined, and you don't have a lot of choice in the matter. I mean, you either pay up for the product, or you just cash settle, and you take your money, and you buy the product, you buy whatever you want elsewhere. So those are additional risks that most people don't even fathom. But, you know, for someone like me who's been in the industry a very long time and runs one of the largest private depositories in the business, I run a gold and silver fund. I've been an investment advisor since 1992. I've been doing this for a long time. I buy and sell metal all the time. But I'm an expert in this. But for a lot of people, they don't have the time to go through this whole litany of risks and possibilities and that type of thing.
Absolutely, Bob. And like you say, again, just to reiterate, you know, my goal with the podcast is just to help look at these things from different angles and help educate people. And if there's somewhere we're wrong, we're happy to have that pointed out. But the point is just to have the discussion. And if anybody has any questions about this stuff, please feel free to email me and also, you know, tweet at Bob. We're here to try and facilitate this discussion and, you know, look at all of these different issues from different angles, right?
Sure. Yeah. And then like we were talking about before, you'd always mentioned, well, you know, okay, the responsibility of the program and the loyalty that the program has to the client. One of the things that I've gotten a lot of questions on is, you know, when we're talking about digital programs is Kinesis. I had a chance to go through the agreement that they have. And a lot of people have a lot of positive things to say and, you know, that they really like the convenience factor of the program, which is great. To me, it's not a matter of recommending or dissuading people from going into a program. To me, it's about pointing out certain things that people need to be cognizant of when they do get into a program, because once they're in it, they're in it. The last thing you want to do is be the person on the inside trying to get out versus the guy that's on the outside trying to get in. So one of the things that was brought up in the agreement was they have a limitation of liability and indemnity clause that I think is one of the strongest limits of liability clauses I've ever seen in my life. And again, it's not to be derogatory to the program. It's to point out to people that's interested in it that you basically are very limited in your ability, if something does go wrong, to ever have any recourse to get your holdings back or to get your money back. And that's something that needs to be recognized by people before getting into a program. Because what you don't want to have in the industry is you have something blow up and then all of a sudden you have a lot of people into it. They didn't understand it completely to begin with. And then all of a sudden it makes the entire industry look bad. It's just another black eye. Obviously, our industry has seen a number of these black eyes over the years, and nobody wants to see that pop up again.
Absolutely, Bob. I couldn't agree more. And I think, you know, as a precious metals investor myself, you know, it is kind of a daunting task to try and figure all this stuff out for yourself. So hopefully we can help some people figure that stuff out. Do you have anything else to add here as we wrap up, Bob?
No, that should do it. Again, if anyone has questions, you know, feel free to email me, or you can go to our website to get information or contact information, or see me on Twitter. My Twitter handle, actually, it's Profits Plus ID, so ProfitsPlusID. So you can follow me there. And certainly I'm very open to try to help people understand the program that they're in, or if they're looking for metal in terms of just saying, hey, listen, what should I be paying for something, if I'm overpaying, or if this is reasonable, I'll certainly try to help people in that regard.
Excellent, Bob. And we'll, of course, we'll have your links in the show notes as well. Bob, thanks very much for helping us provide this update.
Sure. Sounds good.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.